of all living entities. Tonight, we have an interesting topic, which I'll try to discuss. No doubt, everyone is interested in success. I don't think anyone here wants to be a failure. What are the dynamics of spiritual success? Because an intelligent person has some doubts about material success. At the same time, material success looks attractive, even though others may have had so much distress in pursuing material success, still, the glimmer, the glamour, the bright lights appeal to us. And we might even say to ourselves that I'll have a different way of being materially successful. I'll avoid all the liabilities, all the problems, all the anxieties, and I will have a genuine, wholesome success materially, which won't injure myself or injure others. I travel on every continent of the world, and on every continent there are persons who hope like that. My material success will be different. It won't be like I just heard today. Your fate won't be like what happened to the tycoon, the entrepreneur who was in charge of Raj Travel, the biggest travel and tourist agency in India, who a month ago jumped off the bridge into the ocean, commit suicide. So there's something that tells us, oh, that kind of outcome is, that's not normal. Why bring these points up? Let's look at those who seem to be satisfied through material success. We're going to be discussing this. So I ask for your kind attention, kind consideration, and hopefully I can say something that may benefit you. So first, I seek the blessings of my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and all the glorious devotional personalities in our line. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Jivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Everything in life has a price. So we have to decide for ourselves how much of a price are we going to pay for our material aspirations. We have some prejudice, perhaps, that if we give ourselves to the spiritual goals, we won't be honoring our capabilities and our full potential. We may have the idea that the world of material success involves utilizing the best of you, whereas the dynamics of spiritual life, that involves religious belief. It involves being a nice person. But in terms of making your contribution to the world, making your mark, act
acting on your God-given talents and abilities. It seems the material success is the best for that. We may have this notion, we may have this idea that the real way to show your significance, the real arena for your abilities is material success. Somehow or other, this prejudice, this bias against spiritual activities is there. What does it mean to do spiritual activities? What about my abilities? What about my talents? What about my drive? Material civilization today means rajoguna and tamoguna, the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance. As you know, in the mode of passion, you struggle and strive very energetically for material goals. And then, naturally, because you'll be frustrated, you won't be satisfied by your achieving material goals, there has to be the mode of ignorance, in which you take shelter of sleep, intoxication, and even suicide. What makes us believers in material success? This is a question we have to ask ourselves. Where did we get this idea from? Who gave us this idea? And then we consider devotional activities, devotional life, as Lord Krishna has taught in Bhagavad Gita. And we may think that's for those who couldn't succeed in the material world. They didn't have the talents. They didn't have the abilities. They were not able to swim with the sharks. And so so they retreated to a life of devotional seclusion, avoiding the world because they couldn't handle the world. They didn't have the skills. They didn't have what it takes. We may not say those things, but we may be thinking like that. Some or other, we have this notion embedded in us that the world owes us fulfillment. The world will reveal to us our glory if we just struggle more, work harder, our day in the sun will come. Right? It's out there, right? Others are getting it, why not you? If you just try harder and harder, it'll be in your grasp. So in this way, we motivate ourselves to push onward. And of course, society, family, and friends all encourage us. Yes, put your all in all into pursuing material goals. That's the normal way. What happens is that we end up struggling and striving so intensely that we never even have the time to question why we're doing what we're doing. In fact, you may even say, to question is a luxury. Who has the time for that? Questioning, deep questioning is done by idle persons. Those who are truly active and powerful, they don't have the time to ask questions. They're doing, they're making things happen in the world. We want to be like those persons who are movers and shakers. What has thinking and philosophizing done for the world? How much money has it made anyway? What fame has it brought them? So we recognize that we have some passions. Passions means lust and greed. Maybe 50 years ago, lust and greed was looked down upon. But in the world that you are making your way through now, lust and greed are glorified. When you enter the job market, the recruiters, the interviewers, they want to see basically how lusty and greedy for material acquisition you are. Of course, if you mention that you do some charity work, you give something to charity, that's appreciated, okay. But the main thing is, how hungry are you to get ahead? Right? Where's your appetite? So now it's considered a great compliment to be called lusty. People will say about someone, he has such a lust for life. Are they saying that yet in Mumbai? It'll come. You'll receive it, such words, as a great honor. Yes, I have a lust for life. And even these days, to be considered greedy for achievement, not greedy in a way that obviously steps on others' toes, but just greedy for nice, wholesome material gain. That's considered very good. After all, you have abilities, you have skills. What are you going to do with those abilities and skills? You're meant to achieve. You're meant to acquire. If we're fortunate, we consider spiritual knowledge, spiritual activities. But we're afraid. What will such knowledge and activities mean for my involvement with the world? Now let's shoot ahead in time to something that will never happen to you. You're never going to die, right? That is true for the spirit soul. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, for the soul, there is never birth nor death. Najayate mriyate va kadachin. But we are thinking we are the body. And even if we have some notion that we are a spiritual entity, we know that in order to get the material success, you've got to focus as a material body and a material mind. The spiritual thoughts are for special moments, but the material thoughts, that's for everyday life, for the real arena of living, the material thoughts. So yes, this body will come to an end. It's good for us to consider what are the major regrets of those who are about to die. The regrets vary from culture to culture, but there are some basic regrets that are always the same throughout the world. So just think. You're priming yourself for success, for achievement. But what is it like for those who are about to leave their bodies, leave this world? How do they look back upon the spent years of their life? Regret number one is, I wish I had lived a life that was more true to myself and what I really wanted to be, instead of living a life so bound up with the expectations of others. This is the number one universal regret in the world that persons have right before they die. Why did I spend my whole life, or so much of my life, living according to others' conceptions, what they wanted me to do? Why couldn't I have been true to my own principles, whatever they were, why couldn't I have followed those? Universal regret number two. I wish I hadn't worked so hard all my life. Universal regret number three. I wish I had done what would have really made me happy. So those are the top three universal regrets. Now just think how that might apply to you. We have our goals, we have our aspirations. Some of it is biological, and some of it is social. You're all young men. You should know the power of the hormones in the body and how they are dictating to you so much. Materialistic scientists will say that basically you are a machine for fulfilling the urges of the hormones. You're a machine for the hormones to utilize to get their way. Young men should know that the male hormone, testosterone, when you become 16 years old, it increases tenfold. So obviously your outlook in life is going to change because these hormones are powerful biochemicals that are dictating to you. You must feel like this. You must do this. Remember when you were innocent little boys before the testosterone increased tenfold? Those carefree days of innocence, remember? Before you became so fascinated by the internet and the movies. Remember those carefree, innocent days? Then the testosterone increased tenfold by the time you're 16. And it continues to increase until you are 21. By the time you're 21, no one here is around that age, right? By the time you're 21, you are a blazing inferno. Then, from the age of 21 in a young man's life, it's a very, very slow decline in the testosterone. So, this hormone consumes so much of our thinking, our endeavors. So, we are, to a major extent, driven by our biology. Then there is social pressure, obligation, duty. Those around you, family, friends, they have expectations of you. And you want to fulfill those expectations. They tell you that you have duties to do. There are things you should achieve, not simply for yourself, but for the sake of others, right? So you have your biological pushings, and then you have the social pushings. And also, you've got your own mind, and you're wondering, I need some part of my life for me to enjoy my senses. Remember when standard life in India used to be so much about duty and obligation? Remember those days? Or maybe that was even before your time? What happened? What is the kind of life that Bollywood and Hollywood present to you? Just go for it yourself. Right? Please yourself. Get what you need, what you want. That's the meaning of life. The more money you get, the more freedom of choice you have. So I notice that so many of you are torn because you've got one foot in both worlds. Still, you're feeling duty and commitment to family and family expectations. Can't deny that. At the same time, you're so fascinated and intrigued by the consumer hedonistic propaganda. I wonder what it's like. I look so attractive. And so you're thinking, how can I deal with both realities? Yes, there's some duties that I should do, obligations to family. Oh, okay. But there's this other world opening up of wonderful hedonism in which you're carefree, right? You can just be the enjoyer, let it all out, and not even care what anyone thinks. Just like what you see in the movies and on television. That's definitely there in your mind. So you find yourself trapped between these two worlds. The world of traditional duties, obligations, and the world of just do whatever makes you happy. So this will be the future of your life. Trying to juggle these two worlds. Or looked at another way, trying to stand up when you have one foot in the duty world, the other foot in the do your own thing world. And the do your own thing world looks attractive because you think, so many generations before me have done the duty thing. Right? But this world of, this exciting new world of just do your own thing, make yourself happy, feel good, however you want to feel good, it looks so fresh, right? No pressures. No moralities, no rules, just however you want to feel, when you want to feel. So this this schizophrenia, for those who don't know, schizophrenia is a psychological term referring to someone who has like a split personality. This is affecting so many young people today. So many decide, I've noticed, that many decide they're going to handle both of these worlds, the duty world and the hedonistic world. You can't ignore either one of them. You can't be completely traditional, simply duty, I have my duty, I have my family obligations, that's all I'm going to think about. Duty to family, obligations to family. You can't go completely that route, and you can't completely go the hedonistic route. So you're going to do both. And that decision to do both consumes so much time, energy, resources. There is another alternative. The spiritual alternative. The Krishna conscious person, the bhakti practitioner, knows how to handle the affairs of this world as well as the affairs of the spiritual world. that kind of insight and expertise comes when we base our life upon spiritual knowledge. So the devotee of Krishna, the bhakti practitioner, becomes such an empowered person. He or she can handle the social obligations and expectations in the most expert way. And he or she can also know how to stay free of the hedonistic lifestyle which drags so many persons down. How can you stay free of the hedonistic lifestyle, the demands of sensuality, which you see everywhere on the internet and in the movies? How do you stay free from that? It seems like those kind of people have all the fun. The sensualists have all the fun. Isn't that what Bollywood and Hollywood are trying to impress upon you? This is the kind of person who enjoys life. Don't you want to be like that? Get money and enjoy in this most successful way. What does a Krishna conscious practitioner do? What does a Krishna bhakta do that can replace such powerful sensual urges? We want to welcome you to the world of spiritual sense objects, spiritual sense activity. This is the world that Krishna provides for those who follow his instructions. Instead of your living a barren so-called religious life, no, by following Krishna's instructions, your real self comes alive and your real abilities manifest. The so-called abilities that we are aware of in material existence, they're just shadows compared to the abilities that will manifest when we engage in Krishna's service. Engaging in Krishna's service takes the best that we have to offer and more. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, he preserves the good that you already have when you engage in his service, and he brings to you further abilities, further expertise. We are speaking the past few days at the Govardhan retreat in Vada about the emotional dynamics of bhakti. I find that especially young men who are career-minded, who have some abilities, some hope for material improvement in the future, they have a fear that the practice of bhakti won't fulfill their inner self. When you, for example, consider the working world, you would love to have a job, a career, in which you were told you can fully express yourself. Simply do your best and more, and it'll all come to you. The appreciation, the recognition, the fame, the money, it's just waiting for you. Just plug in and show us what you can do. Wouldn't you love to have a job like that? Of course, any activity in the material world is loaded with all kinds of impediments, difficulties, dissatisfactions. But we overlook all that. We overlook it because we are lusty and greedy. But we tell ourselves, my lust and greed is normal and it's innocent. It's within bounds, you see. Right? We would never consider ourselves to be a materialist, right? Who is a materialist? How do we define a materialist? A materialist actually is whoever has more than you. Right? They are the materialists. We look at ourselves in our material aspirations and hopes for achievements. We have just what we need, and we could use a bit more, right? But the others, the greedy ones, who have ruined the world, they are the materialists. So in this way, we put ourselves in a favorable light, that our desires are normal. Our pushings from the hormones are normal. It's the others who have problems with lust and greed. You might want to know how it is that devotees handle lust and greed. And in fact, devotional service, the devotional life, can consume unlimited quantities of lust and greed, but not material lust and greed. In bhakti, you'll find the perfection of lust and greed. How is that? The devotee lusts to use everything in Krishna's service. Material life means lusting for everything for your own gratification and the gratification of those you consider at a particular moment to be your family and friends. You all know the term karma. Here is a classic definition of karma, but one you may not have ever considered. One of the great acharyas in our line, in fact, the spiritual master of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, said, karma means any action taken, number one, for your own happiness, and number two, for the happiness of select others. That is karma. We're prepared to endeavor, to achieve, to acquire for our own happiness and for the happiness of a few others who are connected to our body through family relationship or friend relationship. The bhakti yogi, however, has desire. But that desire is all for pleasing Krishna's senses. So the devotee knows how to lust spiritually, how to be greedy spiritually. The devotee is greedy for rendering service to Krishna. Whenever I visit this Radha Gopinath Mandir, and I'm fortunate to have some association with the brahmacharis here, I have concluded that they are among the most lusty and greedy persons I've ever met. They're not what you would expect, right? You would think, well, a brahmachari should be very subdued and very quiet and just walk around all day with the head in the clouds and muttering mantras. That's all But what do you see instead? You see dynamics. You see intense desire. Indeed, I say you see lust and greed perfectly. You see this lust and greed perfectly used for Krishna's pleasure. And that is the most beautiful sight in the world. To see the perfection of lust and greed in action. So in other words, to be on the genuine spiritual path, as Lord Krishna has given in Bhagavad Gita, brings out the best in you far beyond what you could ever imagine could be done in the material world. And actually, the devotee starts to understand that my endeavors for material success were debilitating me. They were wounding me. They were weakening me. Whereas when I endeavor to please Krishna, I become stronger. I become wiser. One reason is that any material endeavor, no matter how innocent we may think it is, results in frustration. And that frustration leads to anger. We have to blame someone because we never get what we want. But in the special circumstances in which we get what we want materially, it doesn't satisfy us. I was speaking recently at a university campus in Australia. And there, people are environmentally aware. They know that the Earth is facing huge environmental problems. The basic facts are that the consumer societies that we have today even if they could just go on consuming, consuming, and consuming, even if there was the unlimited space on the Earth planet to do that, unlimited resources for consumption, and unlimited space to dispose of waste, even if that was so, and you know it's not so. Right now, human beings on this Earth planet are living as if they were two planet Earths. That is the scientific fact. Something is not going to work out, right? They're living as if they have two planet Earths to extract resources from and dispose of waste into. But let's just say you could just go on forever consuming material advancement, economic development. You can just go, go, go. You can't do that, you understand, right? It doesn't work scientifically. You're dealing with limited resources, and you're dealing with limited space to dispose of waste. It's like in your house, or your flat, or wherever you live. How much stuff can you accumulate in your house? Your house is limited. Your home is limited. And when you want to get rid of all the waste, how much space in your home do you have to store all the waste? There's limitations. The planet is like that. But let's just say, let's just fantasize. We allow all the human beings in the world to go for it. Unlimited material achievement and acquisition and consumption. And let's say, in this fantasy, that the world has unlimited ability to absorb all that material acquisition and drive and desire. The world has unlimited space for the wastes. It has unlimited resources to give. You know it's not true, but let's say it's true. So if people had the room, the space, if the world gave that to them, to unlimitedly pursue their material desires, still they would not be happy. Because they can't be happy by such a lifestyle. Now, some persons are starting to understand this, but they don't know what to do instead of such a lifestyle. It's tragic. Even if you could get what you want, you will not be satisfied. I was speaking at University of Cape Town, the most prestigious institution on the African continent. It's founded by the British, and students from all over the world there. And so I was mentioning to them the latest research in the newfound science of happiness. Science of happiness has been officially recognized for about the past 10 years or so. So I told them, there are about 200 students and professors gathered. So I mentioned that I'm sure you're aware of the latest research which shows that any extra income or luxury beyond a basic middle-class standard of living will not lead to any increase in happiness as measured by normal psychological indicators. Once you get to a basic middle-class standard of living, any further increase in money or luxuries won't make you any more happier when you consider happiness in a way that materialists consider happiness. So I asked the audience of 200 students and professors, you all are aware of this. This is a prestigious university. I'm sure you know of this. They all raise their hands. Yes, yes, we have heard this. So then I asked a question that maybe I shouldn't have asked. I said, now I'd like all of you to raise your hand who are prepared to live just a basic middle class standard of living. Out of 200 persons, maybe two persons raised their hand. So what's going on here? In other words, the intelligence may even tell you, but you can't follow through. This is the situation of the world today. And this is also the situation with individuals. Even their intelligence may tell them, I don't think I'm going to be satisfied pursuing these goals. But they can't resist. Have you noticed that in yourself? The propaganda is so intense. The social pressure is so intense. Mm-hmm. And the hormones are intense. So I know that you all are considering, what are you going to do? You can't go back and live like your parents and grandparents. That's the unstated truth, right? I won't talk about it too much. But what are you going to move forward to? What is your path forward? You can't go back and be a complete traditionalist. At the same time, what's up ahead for you? So no doubt, what you're probably thinking is, how about a life of nice materialism? Okay? Innocent materialism, with a few sensual pleasures from time to time. Not overdoing it, of course, but a healthy mixture of what you see in the movies on the internet. honor some family obligations, right? Don't get too extreme about it, right? But keep some good respectability in the family, while at the same time having your own private life. Two worlds, right? The schizophrenia. One foot in the traditional world, one foot in the hedonistic world. But of course, you all are different. You have gathered here at the Radha Gopinath Mandir. So many of you are regulars here. That means that you understand there is something higher in life. But the question may be, how much should I dedicate to this higher pursuit in life? Can it really fulfill me completely? What would it be like to follow Krishna's instructions in a full lifestyle of bhakti, regardless of what ashram you take? What would it be like to be a full Krishna conscious person, living in the Brahmacharya ashram or living at home? Nevertheless, regardless of where you live, what would it be like? What would it do for your inner self? You don't want to sacrifice your potential. You see that I could do something in this world. I have some value. I have some abilities. Maybe it hasn't all worked out for me yet, but it could in the future, right? In the future, I could really come across a great material situation. And if I don't try for that now, I may never know. I may never know my full potential. I could be missing out on a golden opportunity. My life may be a little difficult now, but something could happen in the future. So if I fully follow Krishna's instructions, that might make me miss out. I want to do something. I want to feel like I'm making a contribution. I'm able to produce something significant in this world. How does a devotee of Krishna do that? Actually, the devotee of Krishna does the most significant, lasting things. The Krishna conscious lifestyle invites your full investment of your talents, abilities, drive, enthusiasm. Krishna can take from you all your energies and reciprocate with you far beyond your expectations. This is the wonder of bhakti. You're dealing with the supreme reciprocator. No human resources department at any multinational corporation can compare to Krishna's department for dealing with his devotees. By engaging in devotional service, you come alive. You realize you've been sleeping in your material endeavors. It's the shadow self that pursues the material endeavors. The real self pursues Krishna's pleasure, giving pleasure to Krishna. So what we thought was the real self, full of material lust and greed, ambition, pride, that's the shadow self. And you'll never be satisfied by indulging in the shadow self. That is why Krishna invites you, be for real in bhakti. There's a great need in you to be authentic. You have to be able to live with yourself, you know? You don't want to die with regrets. Why did I live my whole life according to others' expectations? Why couldn't I have been true to myself? You don't want to die with those regrets. It's such a painful way to end the life. And that end of life, of course, can come at any moment. By following Krishna's instructions in Bhagavad Gita, your real self reemerges again. Your real self as part of Krishna, meant to act for Krishna's pleasure. And by acting for Krishna's pleasure, automatically you are satisfied without even having to worry about your own pleasure. Service to Krishna involves so many talents, so many abilities. When you look at this Sri Sri Radha Gopinath Mandir community, yes, you're seeing the deities, you're seeing Srila Prabhupada Vyasa San, you're seeing the glorious devotees, but please bear in mind, you are seeing a whole world of abilities, talents, skills applied with great greed and lust to satisfy Krishna. And there's a place for everyone to plug in somehow or other, whether married or single or undecided. Or pretending to be undecided. There's a place for everyone, a way for everyone to plug in. And in this way, the real self emerges and the shadow self starts to disappear. It's that shadow self that's pushing you around. Go for material goals. Satisfy your material lusts. Be nicely greedy for material acquisition. Be courteous while you're greedy. That's the shadow self. And many of you know this will never satisfy you, this shadow self. So we want to invite you to deepen your investment in Krishna's world. Krishna's world will take the best you can offer and reciprocate with you far beyond what you can ever expect. Krishna's world involves the best talents, the best abilities, the best skills. Not only the talents, abilities, and skills you have now, but Krishna will give you more. Srila Prabhupada once commented that a devotee is someone who knows everything about something and something about everything. How is that? He explained that Krishna's devotee knows everything about something, knows everything about Krishna. Of course, Krishna is unlimited, but as much as can be known about Krishna, the devotee knows. And the devotee knows something about everything. He explained that means that in the course of serving Krishna, a devotee picks up so many different types of knowledge and skills. Knows something about everything, because the world of service to Krishna is ever expanding. So whereas in the material world you're forced to just focus in a very narrow way, anyone who's in contact with Krishna's service increases their abilities. Because the world of Krishna's service keeps increasing. So it's the most exciting life. A you that you're not aware of manifests. First of all, sense control and discipline manifest. Kindness manifests. Gentleness manifests. Peace, inner peace manifests. And what to speak of the highest spiritual knowledge. You indeed begin to practically experience that you are part of Krishna. And you feel Krishna's reciprocation through the chanting, through the kirtan, the japa, the prasad, especially when done in association with devotees. You start to come alive. And that's what you really want. You don't want to be a phony. You don't want to waste your life and die with regrets. You want to solve the schizophrenia. Being with one foot in each world. Well, there are the family obligations and duties. Okay. Then there's what Bollywood is pushing me toward. Yes. Why waste your whole life going crazy that way? Why not learn how to handle the body and mind with bhakti skills? How to become the master of your mind and senses? And why not learn how to deal with the family obligations in a way that's progressive for both yourself and the family members? These are the skills that a devotee knows. And in the course of a devotee's serving Krishna, you become equipped with skills and talents more than what you would ever expect. You're plugging into the spiritual world. Actually, Krishna is the source of all talents, abilities, and skills. So instead of participating in a world which you may fear, I won't be able to express my God-given abilities. I'll be ignoring my potential. And I could regret it later. Oh, why did I spend so much time trying to be Krishna conscious? I didn't chase the material dream, and now I regret. It's not like that. The world of Krishna's service is ever increasing. It takes the best that you can give and more. The emotional dynamics, the inner dynamics of being a devotee. There's no comparison to it. Devotees are so full of life in serving Krishna. Not temporary material life. They're full of eternal spiritual life. They know how to lust. They know how to show greed. All for Krishna's pleasure. That's why you see them all as shining. And you can also be shining even more than you are now. So I'd like you all to start visualizing your career as someone increasing their commitment and involvement with Krishna's service. Somehow or other, start visualizing. That is actually my real career. To some extent, somehow or other, increase your spiritual commitment, increase your devotional involvement. Somehow or other. This way, that way. That's your real career. And then you'll see the spiritual lust and greed develop, which gives such pleasure to Krishna. Please consider this. Your future is in your hands. We've spoken about the pressures. The pressures from the world of duty and obligation, the pressures from the hedonistic world, which is so popular these days. But we're presenting another option, an option that will resolve the problems and pressures caused by those other two worlds. You'll learn how to handle both of those worlds easily with the skills that you learn in your bhakti career. So please consider this. I thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
So let us express our deepest gratitude to His Holiness Devamrit Swami Maharaj for having taken his time out. He's traveling to Tirupati tomorrow and is here with all of us this evening. We'd like to thank him for his very deep analysis of material lust and greed, and giving us the option how to harmonize the two worlds, how to bring the balance. Let us thank him by loudly chanting Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol. We have with us this evening, after over 6 months for the Purina festival, His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj. Maharaj just returned the day before yesterday after his over 6 months preaching tour of the United States, the United Kingdom and Europe. In fact, he returned from London just the day before yesterday after doing amazing programs at reputed universities like SOAS, Oxford, Cambridge. He was also at the HSBC for a corporate event, and he came back absolutely exhausted after such a hectic preaching schedule, and also with bad health. Even today he had just gone to the hospital and just returned back in the evening. Despite his bad health and exhaustion from such a hectic preaching tour, Maharaj has very kindly agreed to be with all of us for this Purina festival. In fact, Maharaj has always been very, very kind to the youth here in Bombay, and our IYS and all the youth forum devotees are very inspired by his kind association. So we would like to welcome His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj once again for the Purina festival by loudly chanting Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol.
Om Gyan Chimitandasya Gyananjana Chalakaya Chakshuru Lilitanjena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutalaya Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nitinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Aschatyate Satharine Vansha Kalpatarupyascha Kripasindubhya Evacha Hathithanam Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Brinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama
I am so grateful to be with all of you this evening. Special gratitude to His Holiness Devamrita Swami Maharaj for his brilliant soul-searching enlightening Harikatha. Thank you. He transformed our hormones. His words made our hormones dance. Maharaj was so beautifully speaking about not destroying the natural inclinations of the human heart, mind, and senses, but transforming them. The Srimad Bhagavatam explains that when you put water on the root of the tree, that water reaches every part of the tree. And similarly, when we focus our body, our mind, our words, our desires, our greed, our lust, and all the other things that he was discussing toward selfless service to Krishna or to God, then it has an opposite effect. Instead of entangling us in material complications, it liberates us. And just to add something to what he said, I'd like to offer some living examples throughout history, especially in Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, which illustrate this. Lord Chaitanya is Krishna. The Vedic literatures tell us that in this age of Kali, once in a day of Brahma, Krishna appears in the role of his own devotee to teach us how it's practical, accessible to everyone to achieve this greatest of all treasures, the Premadhan, the Purushartha Siromani, the jewel of love of God. There was a king named Prataparudra. He was the undisputed king of the entire Orissan province, which in those days included Andhra Pradesh and that whole area. He was called the Gajapati. He was undefeatable. Even the time when there were Mughal emperors conquering India, they could not penetrate his kingdom. In order to do that, you really have to have it together. He had armies, military, he had spies. That's what you need in those days when you have enemies all around you. He had economists. He had a massive treasury. He had laws. He had courts. And he didn't have to worry about elections. I just came from America, and everyone, everywhere, is talking about elections. And this happens every 4 years. Because really, you could be in a very powerful position, but you really don't know if you're going to have it beyond the next few years. And after 8 years, you know you're out. But in the days of these monarchs, they come in, they're king, usually when they're teenagers, and for their whole life. So King Prataparudra was a very, very talented person. Materialistically, he was topmost. But then he heard from his teacher, his guru, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that Krishna had appeared in this age of Kali as Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya was living in Jagannath Puri, which was his kingdom. Because Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had such deep faith, and he had such realization of who Lord Chaitanya was, the king believed him immediately. He said, I need to meet him. Now when a king wants to meet a beggar, sannyasi, that's usually a great honor. But when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya told Lord Chaitanya that King Prataparudra wants to meet you, the Lord said, I'm a swami. And in those days, swamis didn't meet kings. Sarvabhauma said, but he's not an ordinary king. He's a saint. He's a Rajarishi. Lord Chaitanya said, still, what will people think if I'm meeting people with so much money and so much power? When this news came to Prataparudra Maharaj, he said, it's not that he had to think about it really deeply. From the core of his heart, he immediately said, then I will give up my kingdom. If my kingdom, if my being a king is an impediment to meeting the Lord today, I'll not only give it up and give up my palace, I will live in the street like a homeless person and become a beggar. That will be my greatest treasure. That will be the greatest conquest of my life. And he meant it. And all the devotees around, they were very pleased to see his sincerity, but horrified because he was such a good king. He was so fair, so honorable, so protective, and he was running the kingdom, so everyone was happy. Physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So they somehow or other tried to keep him as king and connect him somehow or other to get Lord Chaitanya's mercy, which they did. That's a long story. But the conclusion was, King Prataparudra used his wealth, his intelligence, his popularity, influence, everything for the purpose of pleasing the Lord, serving the Lord, and genuinely uplifting everyone's consciousness in a spirit of compassion. Because he understood nothing is mine. Everything ultimately belongs to the Supreme Lord, to Krishna. Proprietorship means control. If you own a place, people can't just say, you have to get out. But in this world, our body, our homes, our wealth, our family, our abilities, our intelligence, at any moment it could be taken away. And inevitably at death it will be taken away. So it's never really ours. It's in our care. And this is the spiritually enlightened way of seeing this world. That whatever intelligence, abilities, wealth, influence, whatever there may be, it belongs to God, to Krishna, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, and it's in my care. And let me use it in harmony with the will of the proprietor. That's bhakti. By using our talents and our gifts in this way, we are watering the root of the tree. And not only do we find the greatest satisfaction, but everyone do. And there are so many beautiful stories about King Prataparudra, how he maintained his position, his family, his influence in pure dharma. To show the world that whatever position we are in, if we just harmonize it with the spirit of pure bhakti, it becomes the source of our own liberation and the source of liberation of the world. And then we have Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami. They were the prime minister and home minister, finance minister for the king of Bengal. They were so efficient and proficient in what they did that the king, who was a Mughal ruler at the time, he loved them like his younger brothers. He totally depended on their skills and their influence. And he literally shared the property of his kingdom with them. Their names were Dabir Khas and Sakar Malik at the time. He gave them vast tracts of land. They built palaces, beautiful lakes and forests. They had so much everything. Power, knowledge, wealth, popularity. But when they met Lord Chaitanya, they just wanted to serve him. And they left everything. They didn't take anything with them. They went to Vrindavan. And what did they wear? In order to get there, Sanatana Goswami had to be put in prison because he was leaving behind his prime minister duties, and he escaped from prison. And he was one day he's the prime minister of the whole country, and the next day he's a fugitive by his own choice. Usually you're like that because you get caught doing something. But he didn't do anything wrong. By his choice. And when Rupa and Sanatan were living in Vrindavan, instead of royal garments, they were wearing simple loincloths. Instead of living in palatial mansions, they were sleeping on the ground, on the riverbank, or in the forest, under trees. They didn't have roofs over their heads. Instead of eating fine foods, they were just begging for some dry rotis. But they were always in the highest ecstasies of love of God. But interestingly, even when they were Goswamis, the crest jewel, highest example of renunciation, they still utilized the skills and the things of this world, but without selfishness. If you go to Vrindavan, the most the most beautiful, ancient, architecturally magnificently designed temple in all of Vrindavan is Radha Govinda Temple. And that's even after it has been, you know, attacked by enemies over these centuries. It was built 500 years ago. Still the most magnificent temple in Vrindavan. Hand-carved sandstone. Rupa Goswami inspired and designed that temple that still stands today. Not for himself, for the world. So that Vrindavan would be a holy place, so that millions of people for generations and generations to come would learn the art of bhakti. Devamrita Swami Maharaj was talking about this lust and greed for Krishna. To build a temple like that, you have to have a vision. You have to have deep desire. And Sanatan Goswami's Madan Mohan Temple, to this day, 500 years later, is the very symbol of Vrindavan. Still standing. It's magnificent. And the books that they wrote, they didn't just sit around and, you know, wait till it was time to beg rotis. They were dynamic. They were empowered. They were enthusiastic. They had passion and greed for Krishna. Rupa Goswami wrote so many incredible literatures. The Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the Vidagdha Madhava, the Lalita Madhava, the Upadeshamrita. Dozens and dozens of books, and their nephew Jiva Goswami wrote over 100,000 Sanskrit verses. And writing these books in those days, it wasn't like cutting and pasting, you know, from the internet. You had to be enthusiastic to write a book in those days. It was intense. Just 4 days ago, I spoke at the Cambridge Union in Cambridge University, and the topic they gave me, I didn't think of it. They gave it to me. That's usually what happens in my life. It was how simple it was in the days when apples and blackberries were just fruit. And they asked me to speak on this book, The Journey Home. So I began by saying, you know, they thought of the topic because I wrote The Journey Home on an Apple computer. And this is the fruit, whatever it may be. But in those days, to write a book, you had to go out and get palm leaves. You had to climb trees and pick palm leaves. So you had to get bark from trees and you had to process it with natural herbs and with natural, you know, the sunlight and with water. It took a lot of time to process a leaf so actually what you write on it, it's going to last. Then they had to carve with like a special writing tool, carve the Sanskrit letters into the palm leaf. And then they had to get herbs from the ground that made a color and then fill in those carved marks so that it's actually like an ink from the ground. And when Lord Chaitanya saw one of the palm leaves of Rupa Goswami's writing, he started to cry. He was so amazed. He said, Rupa Goswami's handwriting is like rows of pearls. It's so beautiful, so artistic. Every single letter has such artistic value, such devotion, such thoughtfulness. And he's sitting, Vrindavan, in the summer, it gets sometimes 50 degrees Celsius. In the winter, it gets really, really cold, freezing cold. And he didn't have heater, he didn't have air conditioner, he didn't have fan. He was just under trees. It takes some serious enthusiasm and determination to write these books like that. And to build temples like that. And to excavate holy places that millions and millions of people are coming to in Vrindavan. They were the ones who excavated these places where Krishna had his leelas. So even though they were brahmachari swamis, goswamis of the highest order, still, they had such a passion. They had such a greed to serve. Their passion and their greed was compassion. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he didn't need anything. He wanted them to do all of this for the welfare of all humanity, for the welfare of all living beings, for generations and generations, centuries and all time to come. Their passion, their greed, was an expression of their love for you and for me. To give us the real treasure of life. Imagine, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, they were what's equal today to be billionaires. They left all that. And in exchange, they got a treasure that was infinitely more valuable. A treasure that was infinitely more satisfying. And what was that treasure? Prema. Love for Krishna. And what is the price of that treasure? Bhakti, our sincere devotion. They were tasting it. They were feeling it. They wanted to share it with the world. They saw how the world was so much mesmerized by all the glittering things that they had. And they wanted to show the world how all these beautiful glittering things that we had, they can be used in a way that actually bring us close to the real treasure of life and don't distract us. The weapons of mass distraction are everywhere. Yes, in the renounced order, or in the worldly order of Grihastha, whatever it may be, that passion to serve with love, with devotion, with compassion is the greatest of all treasures. And it's something everyone could do. Just a few days ago in London, I spoke at the HSBC Bank. And the HSBC Bank leadership asked me to speak on the subject of the responsibility of having wealth. I didn't even have to say it. The person that introduced me said, you know, we're asking Radhanath Swami to speak on the responsibility of having wealth. And he hasn't had a checking account since 1969. And they looked at me like, oh. I had to redefine wealth a little from their perspective. It was a wonderful reception. But the person who made the closing remarks, after my talk was Alfred Brush Ford, who's one of my dear godbrothers, who Srila Prabhupada named Ambarish. He's the great-grandson of Henry Ford, who's practically the founder, pioneer of the entire automobile industry as we know it today. So, people told me afterward that they said, you know, this Mr. Ford, he sounded more like a Swami than you do. And I had to admit, he actually did. But he was telling these directors and CEOs, and there were many British lords that were present, he was telling them about, he spoke a lot of very realized, experienced wisdom of being in this world, but not of this world. And he was talking about how he's building this temple in glorification of Lord Chaitanya in Navadvip Mayapur. And how, you know, he's taking literally tens and tens and tens and millions of his own dollars, and how for years, even with many impediments and disappointments, he just won't give up. Because Srila Prabhupada wanted this temple as a place where people from all over the world will be able to really understand and experience the true treasure of India's Dharma, of India's spiritual culture, as Lord Chaitanya presented it. Prema Pumartha Mahan. The highest of all goals, the greatest of all treasures, is the awakening of the love for Krishna that is within the heart of every living being. And how this love for Krishna, Lord Chaitanya taught, can be realized, can be directly experienced, whoever we may be. If we understand this principle of Yukta Vairagya, how to utilize the gifts of this world in a spirit of seva, unselfish service, rather than selfish egoism, by watering the root of the tree. And how we can actually have this experience awaken in our heart if we learn the art, the science of chanting the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada was a Goswami like Rupa and Sanatan. He had nothing himself. He knew he would never see this temple to live in it. He was already in his late 70s when he gave Alfred Ford the instruction, please build this temple for the world, so that millions and millions of people from everywhere will come to really to associate with people who can present the science of Sanatan Dharma, pure bhakti, and convince their hearts, experience the treasure of this holy place. So since Srila Prabhupada has left 1977, Ambarish has been working and working and working, and now the temple, he's already put tens and millions of dollars, he's put about 30 years of practically his full attention. And you know what I was thinking when he was speaking? I was thinking that Alfred Brush Ford has as much passion and greed to build this temple for Lord Chaitanya as his great-grandfather had to build Ford cars. It's a fact. It's very, very practical. It's very simple. Devamrita Maharaj was talking about the brahmacharis being so enthusiastic with such strong desires. But the household ladies and gentlemen of our congregation have the same intense, strong desires. Some are industrialists, some are software engineers, some are students, some are professors, some are into engineering or politics, whatever it may be. Bhakti is a change of heart. And expressing that change of heart in such a way that we can not only transform ourselves, our families, but we can be instruments in helping to transform the world, to find the real fulfillment that everyone is seeking, that connection with the all-beautiful, all-sweet, supreme personality of Godhead. Thank you very much. Another very special guest who's humbly in the shadows, Malati Devi Prabhu. She is one of Srila Prabhupada's original loving servants. The passion she had to serve Srila Prabhupada, I can't tell you all the things that she used to do. She and five others started a temple in San Francisco with nothing. They started a temple in London with nothing. They came to India. She was Prabhupada's cook. Yamuna Devi, another person who just left us, is Yamuna Devi Prabhu. She was such a saintly lady. She would tell me that Malati Devi, she would, to cook nice prasad for Prabhupada, if they were traveling in the early 1970s on a rickety old Indian bus jostling through the holes, she would be cooking lunch for Srila Prabhupada. Passion! Agreed to serve! Malati Devi, could you come please forward? Can we pass the microphone to her for a moment? She's our very senior god sister. The end of 1966, she came to Srila Prabhupada's loving service.
Hare Krishna. Maybe in my next birth I'll be able to sit among these brahmacharis and listen to these exalted topics on these special occasions.
Maybe in our next birth we will be saying what you're saying.
I enjoyed very much hearing your glorification of Ambarish Prabhu.
Thank you very much.
Such a very humble personality. And he has the qualities that Prabhupada said there are three qualities. And if any one of these three are missing, then there will certainly be failure. So he said first was determination, enthusiasm, and patience. So I think we can see these three qualities in Ambarish Prabhu's consistent behavior in serving Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna. So let us thank His Holiness Radhananda Swami Maharaj for such an enlivening discourse on how to use our passion in the spirit of compassion through the examples of Maharaj Pratap Rudra, Rupan Sanatan Goswami and Ambarish Prabhu by loudly chanting.